I think every strong woman in history has had to walk down a similar path, and I think it's the strength that causes the confusion and the fear. Where does she get it from? Where is she taking it? Where is she going to use it? Why do the public still support her?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Tonight we visit a Nazi estate the size of a small country in Chile, which was only shut down 10 years ago. And we can't let September the 11th, that's today, go by without taking another pop at the official conspiracy theory we're all supposed to believe, of it all being done by Bin Laden from his Afghanistan cave. Some believe that he was one of the main instigators of the 9/11 attacks, and he just happened to be hanging around BBC's London studios ready to go live on air on September the 11th, 2001. Let's hear former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak on 9/11 itself on BBC World before the planes had even crashed into the World Trade Center. He knew who'd done it. Also, the Russians are in Syria and want to help us to destroy ISIS. After a year of us supposedly fighting ISIS, while ISIS only gets bigger and more powerful, who can blame them? And from last week, the one airliner that was allowed to leave otherwise closed US airspace on the afternoon of the 9/11 attacks. Who was on it and where was it heading? And the Crown Prosecution Service, who are they and what do they do? So tonight we begin, and we're joined by Barry Hughes, Chief Crown Prosecutor for the South West, to ask him just that. Hi, Barry. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Tell us, what is a Chief Prosecutor?
I'm appointed by the Director of Public Prosecutions, statutory job. There are 13 of us. We each look after an area of England and Wales. We're responsible for all prosecutions. So I look after the South West of England.
So, are you a civil servant?
Civil servant, senior civil servant.
Now, look, one of the things that puzzles me is the name Crown Prosecution Service. Is this part of the government or is it part of the Crown? Almost like you're a courtier of the Queen or something.
It's an interesting question. Some would say we should be called the Public Prosecution Service, but our title is Crown Prosecution Service because that's what we were called when we were formed in 1986 by the Prosecution of Offences Act. Formally, all the prosecutions were undertaken by the police, who investigated and prosecuted. So there was a separation of responsibilities when we were formed. Interestingly, we're the only major public service that was nationalised by Margaret Thatcher.
Okay, so it was was it somehow a private thing before that?
Well, it was divided up among the different constabularies of England and Wales. They did it all themselves. They handled it in-house. They either had their own in-house solicitors department or they sourced it out. But when we were created, it's one national organisation that's entirely independent of the police.
So how does this all work? Are you more government? Are you more Crown? Or are you more judiciary? Whereabouts do you sit?
We're not judiciary.
No.
And we're not government, and we're not Crown. We fit somewhere in the middle. So our line of accountability to government goes up through the DPP, who's in effect our permanent secretary, and she reports through to the Attorney General, who sits effectively as a member of cabinet. But he has a superintending responsibility over the CPS. We sit slightly at arm's length, which allows us to handle some fairly tricky issues, such as the prosecution of MPs.
Yeah, of course, and maybe even the prosecution of the Queen. I mean, would you be able to do that? Is that feasible or not?
We haven't tried that yet.
You haven't tried that one. What about one of the reasons I noticed looking on your website, you have to have a realistic prospect of conviction in order to bring a case. So this is one of the things you look at to decide whether you're going to actually bring a case or not. So how do you decide whether something has a realistic prospect of conviction? Isn't that really a kind of judgment call? Simple, you could say yes, you could say no.
Well, you could reduce it to something as simple as yes or no. Generally, we provide a fairly detailed analysis of our reasons for prosecuting or not prosecuting. It's an exercise in professional judgment. Generally, the longer a person does this, the more support and guidance they get. We have copious amounts of policy which support people. it can be a really difficult job trying to determine whether there's a realistic prospect of conviction. Do you want me to just describe what a realistic prospect is? People describe it as a 50% test. It's not that. It can't be reduced to a percentage. What it does mean is that we need to be satisfied that a properly directed independent tribunal is more likely than not to convict the accused of the offence with which they have been charged.
Now, you know what it sounds to me is if you're being judge and jury, actually, before the court case has even started.
In some cases, that is, in effect, what we do. Not through the formality of a judge and jury, but if we look at a case and we decide that there's insufficient evidence to bring the case before a court, it stops there. We don't prosecute it. And that, as you might expect, produces a range of concerns by various people, depending on whether we prosecute or not.
Now, we've had the Police Federation in here and also Superintendents Association over the last few years, and a lot of them cite difficulties with the Crown Prosecution Service. Now, they're beavering away. They think they've got plenty of evidence. They've managed to find evidence on a particular someone they think it should be convicted or certainly charged. And then they find they send this off to you guys and you say, actually, no.
That's correct. In some cases, we do say no. The police are fantastic at what they do. They protect the public, they investigate crime, and they put the product of their investigation to us. They build a file. Then it comes to a professional lawyer, an experienced prosecutor, who knows the rules of evidence, who knows what the law is, and they apply their professional judgment and experience to the case to determine whether there really is a realistic prospect to
conviction. But that's effectively just a legal opinion, isn't it? I mean, you get some lawyers who are more biased towards the establishment, say, and less towards ordinary people.
Yeah, just as you might get the same with police officers.
And journalists.
And journalists. All of us. Our job is to be independent, objective and impartial.
But how do you make sure you are being unbiased? Because that seems to me to be one of the dangers of your office, is that people may be able to prove even, or maybe it may accuse you of saying, well, actually, you're favouring one side or another in this case. In fact, I think I'm right in saying there was a case a couple of years ago of a Crown prosecutor over in Wales who, because he was quite, I think he was several, maybe six-figure sum, maybe £20,000 in debt, he was actually taking bribes.
That's correct. That was a very, very rare case, and it was one which caused a great deal of concern within the organisation.
So how accountable are you that you're not being biased? Are you how open and accountable? Because I imagine you can't obviously be open, otherwise people, totally open, otherwise people would be challenging you more.
Well, people do challenge us a great deal. If I can just have a moment to deal with some of this. In any case which the police bring to us for a charging decision, which is any case going to the Crown Court and most of the serious magistrates court cases, the police are not authorised anymore to charge an offender without our authorization. So they bring the case to us, we assess whether there's a prospect of conviction or not, and we so authorize. In cases where we decide that there is not a realistic prospect, often the officer who's handling that may be less than happy. They have a right of appeal, an escalation if you like, which takes it up one level and then can take it up at a second level, which will take it to a very senior police officer who will refer it to the CPS. So it's not an unfettered discretion. There are opportunities for the police to appeal against the decision. And introduced in 2013 with something of more fundamental importance, which is that victims who see a case where they have reported a crime as the victim and we decide not to prosecute, they can invoke what's known as the victim's right of review, which then sets in train a further escalation at two levels within the Crown Prosecution Service. And that has been a very open exercise, which has seen cases where one prosecutor has decided not to prosecute, another prosecutor will look at it once the victim has invoked their right to review, and will either say, yes, I agree with the original decision, or in a small number of cases, they overturn it and we start a prosecution.
Barry, you're not hopefully doing all this on your own. Do you have a whole sort of team of solicitors underneath you?
I've got solicitors and barristers. We've got not as many staff as we used to have, but we have a couple of hundred staff spread across the southwest. And in the Crown Court, we instruct barristers to prosecute the cases on our behalf to our instructions. So overall, it's a fairly large operation, as you might expect, running from the tip of Cornwall all the way through to the top of Gloucestershire.
And just give us an idea of your average day. Do you actually have to go to court yourself?
I do go to court. I very rarely go to court on my feet. They don't let me do that anymore. But that's what I used to do for many years. I can still do it, but I've got people who are better at it than me. I lead, I manage, I do a lot of work with our headquarters over in London, and I supervise the high-end cases that come our way, and I make decisions on the most difficult cases.
Another one of your criteria you have to use before you prosecute somebody, or before a prosecution goes ahead, is whether it's in the public interest. Again, actually, there's quite a lot of a spectrum of what might be someone's decision of what is in the public interest won't necessarily be someone else's, won't it?
Yep. People can have very different views about whether a prosecution is in the public interest.
Can you define it?
We've tried to, and we've refined it over the years. We have a publicly available document on our website, the Code for Crown Prosecutors, which describes what a realistic prospect of conviction is and goes on to define the factors that make up the public interest stage of the test. And there are a number of them. The most important one is how serious is the offence. Then goes on to look at issues such as the culpability of the offender, the impact upon the victim, the wishes of the victim, the age of the offender, and so we've got a range of factors set out in the code which define the public interest stage.
I hate to say it, but I think maybe I ought not to, but I will say it anyway. Couldn't we just get rid of you guys and let the police do this job as they used to do?
You could. That's how it used to happen. And we had a what led to the formation of the CPS was that the police would investigate and then prosecute, and inevitably, having investigated and decided somebody should be charged because there was a good prospect of conviction, that prosecution would be maintained. And in many cases, those prosecutions were maintained against people for a very long period of time, by which I mean well in excess of a year. Suspects held in custody, comes to court, barristers are instructed, they look at the case at that stage and realise there is no prospect for conviction and the case falls apart. Victims' expectations have been held unrealistically high for a long period of time. People who are innocent until proven guilty, have been held in custody for a long time, and it was thought right, and I absolutely agree with this, that there should be a separation of powers between investigation and prosecution. It provides greater safeguards for victims and for suspects.
I think there's quite a lot of people around who will feel that there are certain areas. I mean, for example, with this Greville Janner case recently, which has been the decision has been changed now. It looks like there will be a prosecution, whereas previously the Crown Prosecution Service in London found, or somewhere else, some other part of the country found, that there wasn't a realistic prospect of a conviction. They've now changed their mind. So there are some of these heavyweight subjects, like, for example, the VIP paedophile scandal, and I'm thinking of the other one, obvious one, has got to be the banksters, the big banks. You know, how is it that these people haven't, many of them haven't actually been charged? Because surely that comes down to the Crown Prosecution Service too. I think most of us understand that if you steal or whatever, you're doing something obvious, and maybe even if it's only a bottle of water from Tesco's, that you will be charged and you will go through a magistrate's court or whichever. But it seems that there are some crimes, it's almost like some people are too powerful and too big to jail. I'm thinking particularly of these VIP paedophiles and banksters.
Well, there was an argument a few years ago that MPs were effectively above the law. We've proven that that's not the case. There are a number of high-profile celebrities who have operated in a way that is sexually abusive for many years, who undoubtedly felt that they were above the law. Many of them were much-loved public figures. We've shown repeatedly that we can successfully prosecute these people. As far as we are concerned, there is nobody who is above the law.
Well, that's good to know. How does the whole procedure work, though? If someone believes they've got evidence, they may have already been to the police, they may have been to the press, they may have been to all sorts of people with that evidence. If they still feel that justice hasn't been done, should they just simply go to a police station? How does this whole prosecution and how does the process begin? And then maybe you could take us through how it then progresses to someone actually getting prosecuted.
The process starts when someone reports a crime. Or it may start when a police officer witnesses a crime. That's when the police kick into operation. They'll conduct their investigation. In very large and complex cases, they will often involve the CPS at an early stage to guide and advise, certainly in cases where there are surveillance issues, for example, or where the evidence is of a particularly complicated nature. We will become involved well before charge and will be advising the police at that stage. That's unusual, and that's reserved for the biggest cases. Certainly our counter-terrorism division operates in that way. But in mainstream crime, it will comprise a report by a member of the public, which will go to the police, who will investigate. And if the police consider that a crime has been committed, where there will be a realistic prospect of conviction, they will bring the case to us in cases where they require CPS authority for charging. And in other cases, they will charge it themselves, at which point it enters the system as a charge at court, and we take responsibility for it from that point in time.
The thing is, it seems like there's quite a lot of hurdles, aren't there? If you come up, you've got some evidence, and you believe you've got maybe even witnesses to back up what you're saying. It's quite a lot of hurdles to get over before it actually comes to court. And I think, I mean, I'm not the only person that thinks that there are powerful people out there who can put influence on this whole process.
I can't say that in my 26, 27 years of prosecuting, anyone's ever tried to influence me improperly in any way whatsoever, and I think my staff would say the same. I do understand that it can be a very daunting process reporting a crime and following it through, and especially the point of giving evidence in court is very difficult. We understand that, and there's a greater awareness of the impact upon people these days. But there are protections, there are safeguards for victims. We take certain types of crime through the courts in a different way than we used to. For example, we've had a very significant upsurge in reports of non-recent allegations of sexual abuse, which has been fueled by public awareness following Jimmy Savile, everything like that. And we are prosecuting cases now which we would not have prosecuted 5 or 10 years ago. In some cases, I have to make a decision as to whether to instigate a prosecution in a case where 10 years ago the CPS advised that there was not a prospect of conviction. That's a difficult and finally balanced matter, but we are prosecuting.
Hang on a minute, because there you're in a bit of a weird situation there, because how can, even if there's the same evidence in front of you on two different occasions, one time you think there's a good prospect of conviction and another time no. So how does that square?
Well, sometimes it so transpires that further evidence has emerged. It may be, for example, on a cold case review, which you understand what a cold case review is. It's a case which has been rejected maybe 15 years ago. DNA evidence or other forensic evidence arises in the meantime, and so we then have a realistic prospect of conviction because of new evidence. But what you're talking about, I think, are cases where on a reconsideration of the same evidence, we form a different view. Now, that is difficult territory, and that's why I have to make the decision personally as to whether to reinstate a prosecution. And I do so on the basis that the original decision was one which would be considered wrong and where the public interest requires a prosecution.
Can you actually influence sentencing at all? Because we've had this, we were discussing in the first hour, this German teacher up at Clifton College who'd been filming children. He's been given, I think, is a 3.5-year sentence. Quite a lot of people associated with the case have been talking to the press saying, well, they think this is a ridiculous sentence for what the guy's done. I mean, so do you have any influence over sentencing?
We do. Indirectly and directly. We influence sentencing by the choice of charge that we place before the court. So in some cases we could choose a more serious charge or a less serious charge. We make that choice. When it comes to sentencing, we make representations to the tribunal, the judge or the magistrates, and we will assist with views on what the right sentence should be. In cases before the Crown Court, we have the power in certain offences to refer a sentence as unduly lenient to the Attorney General for consideration as to whether to place that sentence before the Court of Appeal, who can overturn the sentence if they think fit. And we've done that repeatedly.
Sounds like you've got quite a lot of influence, actually, Barry. You know, we don't hear much of you, but you sitting in your desk. How did you end up doing this job? What's your background?
I'm a barrister. And I always had a great interest in crime, not from the wrong side of the fence, I hope, but I just wanted to do something which interested me hugely, and the only part of my law degree which really rocked my boat was crime. It's not the best paid part of the law, But it's immensely interesting, and prosecuting criminals is a vital public service that my staff and I feel about very passionately, which is why I'm still doing it.
So you mentioned already some certain, or at least you'd hinted at some cuts you've had in your service. What about across the wider court system? Because we've had, since 2010 actually, quite a lot of cutbacks, haven't we? Even courts being closed. How's that affected what you do?
It's made us all work in a different way. It's made us approach the same issues with a new eye, because we have to continue to perform to a high level, and we have to do it with significantly less resource. And that's manifested, one of the ways that's happened is the courts are presently undergoing a consultation about closing a number of courts. So, for example, Bath and North Avon Magistrates Court have been subject to this consultation for closure. Similarly, in the Crown Prosecution Service, we used to have six offices that ran down from Cornwall up to Gloucester. We presently have two, and we have a smaller satellite office in Truro. So we've closed a large number of our offices, which means we're spending the money we used to spend on increasingly empty accommodation to keep staff.
Now, there's also something that's been introduced called, I think it's called, the criminal court fees, charges for people if they're found guilty. This, I wonder if you'd like to comment on that, because this seems certainly to me and many others as if it's an inducement for a suspect to actually plead guilty when they're not, simply to save having to pay this charge, almost like kind of a form of plea bargaining.
Well, this is not a CPS issue, but we are, of course, influenced by this and affected by it. But it is a fee which people will pay when convicted. And I know that magistrates are concerned about this, and there's been something in the news recently, because the fee is higher if somebody pleads not guilty and is convicted than if they plead guilty. And
well, you
are convicted.
Say it's been in the news. Quite a number of magistrates have actually resigned over it, haven't they?
They have. They feel strongly about it. In one sense, it could be argued as no more than a fairly significant extension of the present scheme, whereby people will pay costs which go to the Crown Prosecution Service for the prosecution. And we charge a higher level of costs for people who are convicted after trial, because it costs us a lot more. This charge, however, does not go to the Crown Prosecution Service, it goes to the court. But I understand the argument, which is people are effectively being defendants here, being persuaded to plead guilty, because they'll have a higher court's charge if they plead not guilty and are convicted. But that argument holds true with the cost that we would seek as the prosecution. So it's effectively an extension of that.
Hang on a minute. How come it costs you more if someone's convicted? Surely, I mean, if you're fighting a case, it's going to cost you the same one way or the other.
No. The difference is between someone who pleads guilty. So someone pleads guilty, they come to court, we present the case, average case in the magistrate's court, it might be a 10 or 15 minute hearing. If they plead not guilty on, say, a drink drive or a domestic violence assault, it could be a full day trial. We will then pay for a barrister or solicitor or one of my own staff to go and conduct the trial. We have to pay the expenses of all the witnesses who go to court. And of course, it takes up a day of court time. So there is a significantly greater cost in going to court for a trial to convict somebody than if they plead guilty at the outset.
You know, something's just occurred to me. We've been talking about court, lots of courts. This is, again, a royal thing, isn't it? I just wonder if, because we, one of the people we had as a guest on here, I'm trying to think, last year, was Stuart Siveray from Jersey. Mm. And he was saying that there was obviously quite a lot of problems down there with the Hope de la Garenne Children's Home, child abuse going on there. And when he and other people in Jersey raised this with the people that run, they were effectively appointed directly by the Crown. And the Crown said, well, actually, we think, or the Queen effectively said, we think these people should stay there. So, you know, it does seem that there is this kind of link back to royalty. I mean, it's a court. It sounds like it's part of, you know, something where the Queen is sitting over over proceedings, and you are part of her prosecution service.
Well, we prosecute for the state, certainly. We are called the Crown Prosecution Service, and when we go to the most serious court, it is called the Crown Court. So there is certainly a titular element there to the word Crown, but we are nothing to do whatsoever with the monarchy, apart from having Crown in our name.
Yeah, so anyway, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. I think we've got a bit of a dilemma in many ways between the whether the police should be doing this and whether the Crown Prosecution Service. I wonder what your thoughts are about how appropriate it's been to bring the Crown Prosecution Service along to separate the entire process of taking public prosecutions away from the police.
Well, if you look in on the continent, they have an inquisitorial system where local magistrates are the people that decide what's going to happen. And, of course, a big example of this would be Fernando Imposimato in Italy, who's the senior judge in Italy, head of the Supreme Court. And he is of the opinion, very clearly, that the intelligence services in Italy were involved in most of the terrorism in Italy in the 80s and the 90s. So he's written a book about it. And the Italian prosecutors put the former Prime Minister of Italy, Andreotti, on trial three times for being a mafia, not a mafia collaborator, but actually a top chief in the mafia. They failed each time because these kind of people have great resources and are able to resist. So when we were talking about the public interest in a case, I would argue that the Italian police authorities there have been right to try and prosecute the state for its crimes, even though they've not succeeded. But of course, because it's not just a question of whether you're going to succeed, it's also pointing the finger and making those inside the state structure who are involved in mafia and terrorist activities that we're going to get you in the end. And in our own country, I think it was still the police who were doing the prosecutions when Sir John Stevens was investigating the British Army's Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland. Brigadier Gordon Kerr, I understood he wanted to prosecute, but he was persuaded not to. But I would argue that he should have prosecuted in that case.
I mean, yeah, Barry, so, I mean, this is ultimately, I suppose, what we're coming down here to saying is, can the state prosecute itself?
Well, I believe that it can. One example of the way we do that, of course, we do prosecute MPs. We prosecute them not just for the expenses scandals, we've also prosecuted them for sexual offences. And we're also responsible for the prosecution of police officers. So when the Independent Police Complaints Commission refers a case through to us, we will handle that, and we also handle lesser offences where there are allegations of crime against police officers at a local level in the southwest, for example. So we do prosecute elements of the state. There are other prosecutors as well, of course. We have the Serious Fraud Office, which will handle some of the big banking frauds. So we don't cover everything, but we do cover most of the mainstream crime in this country.
Well, the trouble with the Serious Fraud Office is they don't seem to prosecute some of the big cases. I mean, there's been, I think there is a quite a long running IPCC inquiry started earlier this year into miscarriages of justice by the Metropolitan Police themselves. What about this whole idea of prosecuting the police? Because a lot of people will say, actually, although there can sometimes be trials of police officers, they're always found innocent.
Well, not always. not always. They are difficult cases to prosecute because when it comes down to it, we will find ourselves prosecuting an individual who is someone who's held a position of great respect in the eyes of the public and who has often performed to a very high level over a number of years. And so it can be difficult to prosecute those, but prosecute them we do, and we do secure convictions.
And what about white collar crime? Because this is one that's very difficult to get the evidence. Often it's hidden within some sort of company vault somewhere or someone's private secret bank account.
Some of that crime can be really hard to tackle, and it's something which is generally reserved for our specialist prosecutors in our fraud division in London, who deal with this sort of thing day in, day out. At a more local level, we do work closely with the centre of the CPS to restrain and confiscate criminal assets for the mainstream crime cases that we prosecute. And again, we have some great successes there.
What can you say finally, Barry, to convince our listeners that there is no such thing as too big to jail? Because, I mean, particularly within higher political circles, the establishment, it's quite clear that there are people who've been quite serious paedophiles and also possibly murdering people, as well as the bankers who've been committing fraud, at least it seems on a vast scale, combined with white-collar crime. A lot of these frauds actually get called mis-selling, this kind of thing. And yet many of them seem to be get off scot-free. We had the trader... can you remember his name, Martin? I can't remember his name. He was called Rain Man, who was sent down. This is about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Yep. But actually, he's a fairly low level guy, and it was quite clear that other banks, maybe in Switzerland or in the city, people knew exactly what he was doing because they were buying him from one bank to another bank because he was good at fixing the LIBOR rate. So, what can you say to convince us that there's no such thing as too big to jail?
Take us back to what we were talking about at the start. If there's enough evidence there to provide a realistic prospect of conviction and it's in the public interest, we will prosecute. And it doesn't matter who they are, whether it's a private individual or in some cases whether it's an organisation, where the evidence exists and the public interest requires it, we're there to prosecute.
Well, let's get the evidence together, folks. Thanks very much, Barry Hughes, for joining us, Chief Prosecutor for the Crown Prosecution Service here in the South West, here on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
And Martin Summers, let's have a chat about some of the other stuff in the news this week. Perhaps we'll start off, though, with the fact that it's the September the 11th today. You're part of this group, aren't you? Reinvestigate 9/11.
I am. We've been pushing for several years now for a proper investigation into what happened, and as time goes on, more and more evidence piles up that the official story simply won't stand up.
I've got a little treat for you now, which I announced at the top of the hour. This is Ehud Barak, and he was, amazingly enough, just hanging around the BBC studios on September the 11th in London, ready to go live on the air. And here he is speaking before any of the planes had actually hit the World Trade Center after they'd just been hijacked.
Joining me now here in the BBC World Studio is the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who's in London at the moment. Mr. Barak, welcome to BBC World. First, your reaction, having heard what's happened. At least four planes have been hijacked, and there may be more.
The world will not be the same from today on. It's an attack against our whole civilization. I don't know who is responsible. I believe we will know in 12 hours. If it is a kind of Bin Laden organization, and even if it's something else, I believe that this is the time to deploy a globally concerted effort led by the United States, the UK, Europe, and Russia against all sources of terror. The same kind of struggle that our forefathers launched against the piracy on the high seas.
In your position as Prime Minister, Defence Minister, also formerly in the Army, were you ever aware of any incident planned like this?
Not in the dimensions, but different elements were there. Clearly there was an attempt on the Twin Towers a few years ago. There was an attempt to explode the Holland Tunnel leading into Manhattan. But of this size and a simultaneous attack, I don't think that anyone had predicted it in advance.
Is it something that security services, intelligence services could ever have got wind of?
I'm not sure, but this is not the case. It really happened in front of our eyes, and the question is what should be done in regard to it in order to avoid it in the future. It's going to be a tough struggle. There will be many tough and painful moments along the way, but I believe that if we will coordinate diplomatic, operational, intelligence and economic activities that will not let them land at any airport and will isolate automatically any nation that is ready to host terror or support them. And by doing this consistently along 6 or 10 years, we will reduce dramatically this challenge to all our way of life.
Well, in 10 years' time, well, actually 14 years later, we still apparently haven't, since there's still this global war on terror going on. That was the Israeli former Prime Minister Ehud Barak speaking on BBC World, Martin, just about the same time as the planes had hit the World Trade Center, and yet he immediately seemed to know that Bin Laden was behind it.
Well, I thought you said in the introduction that the planes hadn't even hit the Trade Center.
Well, just around about the same time as they were hitting.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that he knows an awful lot about this situation, which at the time, why would he have known about this? And, of course, there were five dancing Israelis who were picked up by locals pointing out that they were actually celebrating. They were filming the first plane hitting the tower, and people can look this up. I mean, this is the modern world. They can check this. And they were arrested 8 hours later by the local police, and it turned out they were all Mossad agents, and they were eventually sent back to Israel after interrogation, and they went on television in Israel and they said, yes, we were Mossad agents and we were filming the attack on the Twin Towers, but we were just documenting the event, documenting what was supposedly a surprise attack that nobody had thought about, etc., etc. And of course, the attack on the World Trade Center, which Ehud Barak refers to in 1993, it's quite obvious, and well, it's quite clear from the trial of the people who were convicted for it, that they were actually set up by the FBI. The FBI actually gave them the explosives which they used to plant in a car in the car park at the bottom of one of the World Trade Centers. Six people were killed, but the explosives that the so-called terrorists used had been given to them by the FBI. And the FBI said to the guy who was their mole inside the operation, and he said to them, presumably these are dud explosives and they're not going to explode. They said, no, they're real, we want you to go ahead. So six people there were killed by the FBI in order to create the delusion in the minds of the population that this was being carried out by Islamist extremists, etc., etc. But these Islamist extremists, the Patsies, are recruited by the intelligence services, then dropped into the frame to make it look as if they did it. But in actual fact, what's really going on, just like the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in Italy in 1980, the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in Ireland in 1972, it's actually the intelligence services who are creating the terror, and then they turn around and say, ooh, we need more resources to deal with this terror. And people can't see this pattern, they are fools. After all this time, it should be obvious.
Now, I'm not saying Ehud Barak did it, but he's certainly one of the suspects. Very good article called 9/11 Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World, which I think everybody, every 9/11 almost, should reread this. I mean, it's the article for which the Reverend Stephen Sizer, the author of a book on Christian Zionism, probably one of the world's experts in it, he's a Church of England vicar in Virginia Water in London. Because he posted a link to that on Facebook, that article, he was then told he wasn't allowed to use social media for 6 months. Maybe he's allowed to again now, I'm not sure. But that points out a whole load of links between those attacks on 9/11 14 years ago and the Israeli state. I mean, talking about things like the World Trade Center security being in Israeli company hands, pre-knowledge of the anthrax mailings, security, airport security being in Israeli hands, prior knowledge, there's Israeli citizens being tipped off, anomalous trading and the security markets. And also, there, not least of which, is the a Jewish guy, Alan Saprosky, who's the head of the US Army War College. He's pointed the finger firmly at the Israeli state.
Yeah, he used to be director of studies at the US Army War College, Colonel Alan Saprosky. He's Jewish American, and he's quite clear that the Israeli state was behind the attack. It's his job to know things like that, and he's the one who's blown the whistle. Good for him.
Well, somebody else who points the finger very firmly at the Israelis is the author of a book called Solving 9/11. In Israel, those who conduct genocide, he says, the author Chris Bolin, are promoted to become political leaders. Also, who was on the one airliner that was allowed to fly out of the US on the afternoon of 9/11 itself? So let's go now to the author Chris Bolin. He was originally in the United States, but I think he's living in Sweden with his wife now. And so this was a talk he gave earlier this year, a little extract from it.
And this is the handiwork of Ariel Sharon, the third man in that picture. This is the massacre of the Palestinians in Sabra and Shatila in 1982, in which Palestinian camps in West Beirut, the inhabitants were massacred, thousands of people were massacred, while the Israeli army secured the area around it and provided flares so they could go on with the massacre at nighttime. Went on for like 2 or 3 days. And anybody who tried to get out of the camps was then shot by the Israelis as they tried to leave. This is the man who was found responsible by Israel. The Kahan Commission found him responsible. He lost his portfolio. He lost his position in the Israeli cabinet. He was told that he was unfit to have any leadership positions in the Israeli government. And then in 2001, he got elected as prime minister. And I called my sister, who's Jewish, and told her that this is a very bad constellation. Here we have George Bush, you know, stole the election or whatever. He got elected by the Supreme Court. And this man was in power in Israel. And I said, this is exactly like we had in 1982. And we had Ronald Reagan, who was like a born-again Christian Zionist, along with Menachem Begin. So you had a terrorist leader in Israel, in our ally, with an ideologically committed person in the Republican Party. And it led to the war in Lebanon in 1982. It led to Ronald Reagan sending troops to try and hold the line. So I said, this is not a good combination. George Bush and this fella is not a good combination. And I said, something bad is going to happen. Believe me, these guys are terrorists. This man is what they call a genocidaire. That's a French word meaning he commits genocide. He's done it all of his life. That's what he did all of his life. He killed Palestinians like they were to be slaughtered. This was his assistant, Ehud Olmert, who was the mayor of Jerusalem and became the deputy prime minister under Ariel Sharon. What I discovered was that this man was in New York City on September 11th, although it was not mentioned in the press in New York City. Now, how can that be? The mayor of Jerusalem comes to his sister city, New York City, and it's known to Mayor Giuliani, it's known to the FBI, it's known to the U.S. government, but it's kept out of the New York papers. Why? Why? What was he there for? I found out that he was on September 10th, he was in New York City making a transaction selling a football team, the Likud football team called Beitar. But he didn't leave. He was there. And we know that on September 11th, at about in the afternoon, the U.S. Defense Department allowed one LL-747 to leave from New York to go to Israel full. When nobody else was allowed to fly, LL got to fly that day. They flew home. The bad guys got away.
That's Chris Bolin there, and he's the author of a book called Solving 9/11. Well, he's absolutely firmly pinning this on the Israelis, Martin. I know that's not your position, but is that reasonable?
It is reasonable. I think the Israelis definitely had a hand in it, because the evidence points in that direction, but they wouldn't have been able to do it without allies within the US and undoubtedly the British security structure.
Well, we've also got Benjamin Netanyahu in Britain at the moment, haven't we?
We have.
He's been visiting the UK and protesters demanding he's arrested.
Well, as on the 7/7 in Britain, Netanyahu did not go to a meeting that morning he was scheduled to go to at Liverpool Street, and when the Jerusalem Post phoned up the embassy in Israel, the Israeli embassy in London, said, is he all right? They said, it's fine. We had a warning that there was going to be a terror attack. So in other words, both on 7/7 and 9/11, we have clear evidence of Israeli foreknowledge of both attacks. Now, that doesn't prove they did it, but it certainly makes them suspects, doesn't it?
It certainly does. On to another topic, and we have this week the Russians making an appearance in Syria, at least putting their heads above the parapet. They've probably been there for some time in Syria.
Well, in actual fact, the source of this story, again, is the Israelis. It's from an Israeli website that's gone on about these Russians in Syria. The Russians have always had advisors in Syria working with the Syrian army. They've never denied that. And the idea that they've got more people there than they had before is largely spurious. In actual fact, obviously, we've been talking about the migrant crisis earlier on in the show. I mean, the obvious solution to the problem of Syria is to negotiate a solution. And Putin has been pushing Assad to have early parliamentary elections so that the responsible opposition to Assad can get a foothold and a negotiated solution can take place. The West isn't interested. They've never been interested. They want to overthrow Assad because the Saudis and the Qataris...
I don't understand how in any way this is in Britain's interest. Why is Britain involved in this?
Well, because the Saudis and the Qataris want to put a pipeline through Syria, which will then provide gas and oil to the European Union, which will undercut the Russians. We're talking about geopolitics here. The Syrians said no, and that's when the armed uprising against Assad began.
Anyway,
if he had agreed to it, he would probably still be nothing would have happened.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to former soldier John Banks, who I spoke to. He'll be on the Dialect programme next Tuesday. Tuesday week, which is our sister show on Tuesdays at noon here. But anyway, we'll see what John Banks has got to say about the Syrians and ISIS and the Russians in Syria.
ISIS is, without a shadow of a doubt, an American-Israeli invention. There's absolutely no doubts about it. Let's look at al-Baghdadi. Al-Baghdadi was released from Camp Bukra. He was flown up to Erbil in a US military chopper, where he was flown from there to Tel Aviv in a black operations aircraft. He spent 6 months in Tel Aviv. He was then returned back into Syria via the Golan Heights, and at that time, that was when Saudi decided to release some of its most senior prisoners to go and join with ISIS. If you remember when they let all the prisoners out of the Saudi jails, they were being flown in by Saudi aircraft and American aircraft into bases close to where ISIS was built up. The weapons, you don't mistakenly airdrop weapons and then get them into the wrong hands. They've been dropping weapons into ISIS's hands. They've been supplying moderate rebels who immediately surrender within the 1 or 2 days and calmly go and join ISIS or al-Nusra and hand over the weapons. How does oil manage to get out when we know that the satellites can spot the oil tankers? Why aren't they being arrested? With all the capabilities of investigative units tracking down money laundry and money movements, why isn't anybody seeing who's paying for this oil and where the money's going to? Why is this big hotel in Mosul that belongs to ISIS, this massive hotel, five-star hotel, running guided tours into Mosul and accepting American Express, Diners Club, Visa and MasterCard?
That's former soldier there, John Banks. You can hear that on our other show, Dialect, in future weeks. Martin, he's making a pretty clear case there that ISIS is a creation of America and Israel.
I think that's what most serious observers in the Middle East believe to be the case. And, of course, they're being used as a boogeyman. It's like fox hunting, as I've said before. We like hunting foxes, so we breed them in Syria, and then we go tally-ho, we've got to go into Syria to get these foxes.
And we've just had drone strikes this week, haven't we, ordered by the Prime Minister David Cameron on British people in Syria.
And there's a very big question mark over the legality of that, especially when I believe, that the intelligence services and the military are behind the terrorism that's going on. They certainly shouldn't be allowed to operate outside the law, because that's exactly where they're trying to take us.
Well, one of the problems here is we don't have an intelligence and security committee. Why has this committee not been formed? This is supposed to oversee the intelligence services. Right now, the intelligence services can do anything they want.
When the committee sits, it doesn't ask the right questions.
Yeah. Because but there's no committee even. There's no oversight of the intelligence services right now at all.
What they're hoping to do with the panic over the so-called refugee crisis and all the rest of it is we're going to go to war with Syria soon. But if Jeremy Corbyn ends up as the Labour leader tomorrow, they won't have the votes in the House of Commons. So that won't happen, at least officially. Although in actual fact, British special forces have been training jihadis to fight in Syria and Libya for years, as anybody who knows anything about it knows to be the case.
Well, certainly not a lot of democracy, it seems, here in the West, particularly when the intelligence services are being paid by us, our taxpayers' money, but there's no oversight of them whatever, and no attempt, it seems, even within since May, to even get a security intelligence community together. So let's go now to our final item, and this is an interview I conducted over in Tehran with Andrei Vilcek, and here he talks about the Nazis over in Chile, particularly at this place called Colonia Dignidad, which he helped shut down.
I'm Andrei Vilcek. I'm a philosopher, novelist, and investigative journalist. I lived actually in South America for many years. Chile was my second home for 2 or 3 years after the collapse of the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. And I was involved in helping to close the very sinister German Nazi colony called Colonia Dignidad. It was actually staffed with many old German Nazis, including Paul Schäfer, who was the head of the colony. He was an ex-Luftwaffe pilot, but there were many other Nazis, many other German, either military or SS people who were at the time already very old. They were some of them in their late 70s or 80s when I began working.
So what was going on at Colonial Dignidad?
Colonia Dignidad was very closely linked to the Pinochet's dictatorship. It was a country inside of the country. It was controlling a huge area of the land between the southern motorway that was leading from Santiago to the city of Puerto Montt, all the way to the mountains, to the border region with Argentina. It was bigger than the country of Luxembourg. There were agricultural farms. Also, the military dictatorship gave the colony, they gave them a contract to build the motorway. They were storing arms. They had light industry, food processing industry. They had a chain of stores in the capital, Santiago de Chile. So it was actually very economically sound, very economically profitable venture. Again, very closely linked to the Chilean military dictatorship.
Yeah, but I mean, what about the dark side? You know, the stuff that wasn't just about commercial dealings with the outside world. I mean, these are Nazis we're talking about here.
Yes, the colony was accused by many, and there were witnesses that I actually interviewed who managed to escape the colony. It was accused of performing experiments, human experiments on people, including lobotomy. They were torturing people, they were molesting children, because the official status of the colony was Colonia Benefactora y Educativa. So it was actually a charity colony and educational colony. So they were allowed by the government during the dictatorship to adopt either poor children or orphans. So they were adopting young boys. Young boys were molested, they were raped, they were experimented on. And those who spoke, they were hunted down. They were caught by the Chilean police from the region and brought back to the colony. And some of them simply disappeared afterwards.
What about Martin Bormann? Because he was rumoured to have actually died in Berlin, wasn't he?
But when I was working there in Chile, and when I was investigating the colony, there were rumors and there were also testimonies of the people in the region that Bormann was actually in the colony, but not only there. He was, according to the witnesses, freely visiting the city of Parral, which is a small city, paradoxically known for some of the greatest Chilean poets and singers like Violeta Parra, but also Pablo Neruda. And I was told that Bormann was visiting pubs, visiting restaurants, and walking through the city of Parral, sometimes even without any escort. So without any fear, definitely.
Okay, what about socialist Chile, though? Because it didn't stay as a fascist country.
After the collapse of the dictatorship in Chile, the legal framework was still in place and the transformation was very slow. It was more effective than in many other countries, but it took a very long time. So the concertation governments under Patricio Alvin and Eduardo Frei were trying to close down the colony, but whenever they would send the police and whenever they would try to change their status, the legal system would kick in and they would change the once again status to the previous ones. It was very difficult to do anything legally about the colony. Eventually, under the government of Ricardo Lagos, a socialist, it was true socialist actually, a police and the army raided the colony. They closed down the institution and many people were interrogated and put on trial. Now, of course, after Lagos came socialist President Michelle Bachelet, her first term, and there was absolutely no way of lapsing to this impunity that existed for decades.
What lessons do you think we can learn today from what happened then?
Well, what happened is that what we always suspected, that after the Second World War in Europe, but also in Japan, allies on the surface, defeated Nazis, were using many Nazis to destroy left-wing movements, political parties and leaders during the elections in Italy, in France and in Germany, but also later on in Japan. So they also used mafias, but let's forget about mafias for now. They were using Nazis, and when Nazis were used, of course, they demanded something back in return, which was a safe passage. And the only continent that appeared at the time totally safe for them was South America. Actually, some of the populists in South America were demanding that they wanted to create a totally white races, particularly in Argentina. They wanted to have the most white country from Tierra del Fuego until the north of Canada. So there was a kind of a match made in heaven for them to get as many white Europeans as possible, and for the United States and UK and other countries to get rid of their Nazis that already helped them, who very often were shipped to South America with the loot of the golden teeth from the victims of concentration camps like Auschwitz. And I was told this by the old Nazis and their children in Paraguay 20 years ago approximately. So they were distributed evenly to places like Paraguay, like Brazil, like Argentina, Chile, and even to Peru. we have to go back to history. This is extremely important because all that we are experiencing now has somehow roots in the history. When we talk about British colonialism, European colonialism, we are talking about North American expansionism, which has roots in the European colonialism. Noam Chomsky correctly pointed out in many of our discussions that the United States is nothing else than a branch growing from the European colonialist tree. So let's not allow Europeans to get away with its past. I mean, we cannot talk about terrorism or immigration now if we are not looking back at what the colonialist powers were doing all over the world. I was recently in Punjab where I saw what the British Empire was doing to the people. They were flogging them, killing them, flogging them publicly, adult people. The Bengal famine in which 30 million people died and in which Winston Churchill absolutely refused to interfere and was basically saying that he's not going to interfere because they are multiplying like rabbits and he's not going to do anything. 30 million people died. How can we really expect the continent with such a track record of indifference and selfishness to get involved now and help the 300,000 refugees that are knocking at their doors? So everything is interconnected. Refugees and terrorism, Europe and the United States, the Western Empire was always looking only at its own interests. The price didn't matter. If the price was killing millions of people, then be it. If the price was to use Nazi criminals in subversing and actually raping democratical election in Europe itself, then be it as well. But the lesson is very clear. We cannot really analyze the present state, be it terrorism, be it immigration, or neocolonialism, without looking back at the past.
That was Andrei Vilcek there. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News.